Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. The tribes on the Wind River Indian Reservation run their own family services agencies funded by the tribes themselves. Federal grants and contracts also come from the state. But the Northern Arapaho Department of Family Services in the larger family welfare system on the reservation has some work to do. Reviews over the years have pointed to big problems, and some of them have gone years without being addressed effectively. Wyoming Public Radio's Irita Zhorov has that story.
22-month Marcella Yellow Bear died on July 2, 2004.
She was basically tortured to death over a period of several weeks by her parents in Riverton.
That's Ed Newell. He was the Fremont County attorney at the time and prosecuted the case. He says perhaps even more horrifying than the extensive trauma the girl's small body had suffered was the sense that it could have been prevented. Northern Arapaho Child Protective Services removed her from her parents' custody and placed her with relatives, but she ended up back in her abusive home, and the agency didn't even know about it.
The fact that she was returned to the home without judicial oversight, without judicial order, without follow-up is something that, I mean, greatly concerned us. We were wondering throughout the course of the case, you know, how did this happen?
Newell never got a satisfactory answer to that question. And during the trial, he says, the Northern Arapaho Department of Family Services wouldn't even share the case files with him, only with a defense team. The girl's father was eventually convicted of murder, but Newell says other things went unresolved.
What I had hoped to see was some sort of acknowledgement that, gee, you know, this was a horrific outcome. This was a circumstance where the system clearly didn't work as it should have, and, you know, we need to take a serious look at the agency and see what changes need to be made so that it doesn't happen again. And my sense is that that never occurred.
This year marks 10 years since Marcella's murder. She would have turned 12 this year. The Northern Arapaho Department of Family Services has moved into a new building, has passed into the hands of a new director, and has undergone some reorganization. Yet, records indicate there were at least another three deaths in the system since 2006, and maybe more. Irina Snoseep worked for the Northern Arapaho DFS from 2009 to 2012.
Of course, the job is pretty stressful. It started out fine, and then I noticed that there was a real accountability problem.
She says workers would come in late and take long lunches. Calls went uninvestigated. The director, who by then was current agency head James Trosper, was not accessible.
I would say maybe he was not in the office. Maybe twice a month he might come in for a short period of time, and he just was not there. He was unavailable.
She says employees did not undergo performance evaluations, and there were few employment standards. She says many caseworkers lacked education, which she sees as necessary for the job. She wrote an email to state DFS, and eventually she quit.
I just couldn't stay there and work.
Others told similar stories. In fact, statistics by the Wyoming DFS for the last 2 years show the agency has the worst track record for timely action and one of the lowest for face-to-face contact with clients. Wyoming DFS recently performed a review of the Northern Arapaho DFS. Program manager for the state social services division, Deborah Hibbard, says the report pointed to a lack of documentation in case files.
Safety wasn't really addressed.
It also said households did not undergo safety and background checks to show that the child's foster home is safer than the previous home.
We saw that maintaining relationships with parents may be a little delayed. Not having a visitation with them, not providing those services.
The report makes it clear that state money is being used to provide a potentially unsafe service. The last contract was for $2.2 million for the year. Hibbert agrees with Noseep that a degree for new hires would go a long way to maintaining a qualified workforce. She says the profession is innately traumatizing to both client and worker, and a relevant education would help with decision making. She says the state provides training, but it's not comprehensive.
Ours is a 4-week course, you know. It's not very many hours. We do hit on trauma, and ongoing trauma within a worker as well as the trauma of the children and the families. But it's, you know, it's a couple hours. It's not weeks of that process when you go through college.
A 2007 report noted many of these same things. It also pointed out that the program needed more caseworkers. But Deborah Hibbert says right now the agency is funded and staffed properly. As for the current report, the Northern Arapaho Business Council says it, quote, mischaracterizes the tribal child welfare system and claims the report has inaccuracies and lacks important context. Director of Northern Arapaho DFS James Trosper, who answers to the Business Council, agrees.
I'm not saying that we're perfect, and I'm not saying that every one of our workers are perfect, but I feel like they're doing a good job. And like no matter how good they do, there's always going to be plenty of people out there criticizing.
Trosper says workers are qualified. He says they use the state's HR guidelines, which call for a degree or experience, and all workers meet one or the other. He says work evaluations are done annually. He also says a lack of documentation does not mean a lack of action.
There are plenty of examples that I know of personally where the worker was just so overwhelmed that they did make the right decisions, and we know that. They did the proper thing, they just didn't put the documentation.
Trosper says background checks on foster parents are done every time, but they're sometimes not input into the statewide system called YCAPS, which he says is burdensome. Trosper also says state offices have more support positions than his, which means his caseworkers have to do more.
So they give us enough funding for the caseworkers themselves and think that they should do the job that their caseworkers do, without taking into consideration all those other positions.
Hibbert says those claims don't reflect reality. As for the recommendations made in the report, Trosper says his department is already doing a lot of these things, and he rejects the notion that he's what some call a ghost employee.
There definitely are meetings and there are duties of my job that do take me out of the office, but there is plenty of time that I'm there at the office. You know, and definitely on a weekly basis, I want to visit with our caseworkers face-to-face.
Trosper is happy to have input, but he says it's unproductive to criticize his workers in what he perceives an unfair manner. He and the business council have gone on the defensive, but Hibbert says she just documented what she saw. Everyone agrees that the population served by the Northern Arapaho Department of Family Services is a vulnerable one. Unemployment on Wind River is high, as is poverty. Crime rates are higher than in the rest of the state. School graduation rates are low. Being a caseworker on the reservation is a hard job. But Ed Newell, the prosecutor in the Yellow Bear case, says that shouldn't be an excuse.
I know that, you know, there are serious socioeconomic problems on the reservation, and lots of challenges to be met. I know it's a very, very difficult environment. You know, I think it's essential to the future of the tribe that they have a good, effective, efficient, well-managed social services agency.
For Marcella Yellow Bear, it's too late. But the state and tribe are working on short-term and long-term plans to address some of the issues, and another review is forthcoming, which the tribe requested to evaluate its program. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhorov.
When we come back, we'll look into the issues surrounding delivering crude oil by rail. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. When a crude oil train derailed and exploded in downtown Lynchburg, Virginia this week, it wasn't the first or even the second time that's happened this year. As growing domestic production of oil strains pipeline capacity, railroads have been picking up the slack. Crude by rail, as it's known, has grown 500% since 2011. But a recent string of accidents has led to concern about its safety. Wyoming Public Radio energy reporter Stephanie Joyce joins us now to talk about how those concerns are playing out in Wyoming and what's being done about them. And Stephanie, first off, thank you for joining me. And here's a simple question for you. Why are these trains exploding?
That's a really good question, Bob. And as I understand it, the answer is at least two-part. If you'll indulge me, maybe I can start with a little bit of history. The accident that really brought everyone's attention to this issue happened last July in Lac-Mégantic, Quebec. And if you remember that incident, an improperly set brake allowed a train carrying Bakken crude oil to roll down a hill into the center of town where it derailed and exploded, killing 47 people and basically obliterating the town center. And before that accident, conventional wisdom had said crude oil doesn't explode. There was a lot of back and forth after the incident about what was actually in the rail cars. But then a couple of months later, there was another derailment and explosion that resulted in the evacuation of Castleton, North Dakota. And after that accident, regulators came out with a warning that the chemical composition of Bakken crude oil might make it more flammable. It's worth noting that the accident in Lynchburg this week also involved Bakken oil. So that's the oil part. But Bob, there's also the container part. Most of the crude oil is being transported in rail cars that are known as DOT 111s. And as one railroader put it to me, they're fine for moving soybean oil, but not highly volatile crude oil. They have really thin walls. They puncture easily. Canadian regulators have said that without modifying their design, they're really not suitable for hazardous materials transport. U.S. regulators have not said that. But they're what's available. And there's been a lot of resistance, particularly by the oil industry, who ends up footing the bill for overhauling and replacing them. So in short, more Bakken crude and inadequate rail cars together seem to be the problem when it comes to explosions.
So there's more crude oil moving by rail across the country. How much of that is actually moving through Wyoming?
Well, Bob, that's a surprisingly hard question to answer. Crude oil is definitely being shipped through Wyoming, but where it's coming from and how much of it there is, that's a little trickier to answer. The national statistics are pretty easy to come by, but it's pretty hard to get state-specific data. I've asked the railroads directly, and depending on who I'm talking to, they tell me one of two things. Either they say they don't keep track or they say they can't share that information. But recently I was able to get a hold of the annual reports that the railroads file with the state. And in those reports, they break down what's being shipped through Wyoming by commodity. One of those categories is crude oil, natural gas, and natural gasoline. And there's no way to know what percentage each of those represents. But when I looked at the national statistics, which are broken down a little bit further, there's very little natural gas or natural gasoline being shipped by rail. So nationally, that category basically just means crude oil. And if that's what it means at the state level, and again, I couldn't get the railroads to confirm this, then crude oil shipment in Wyoming is very much following the national trend. Last year, 16,400 rail cars of crude oil, natural gas, and natural gasoline came through Wyoming, compared to 10,000 the year before, and even fewer in 2011. And anecdotally, people who pay attention to these things do confirm that it's up. James Martin is Cheyenne's fire chief, and he's also in charge of one of the state's regional emergency response teams. And he says all you have to do is look at the cars.
You know, if you go down and look at the rail yards and watch the cars and have an idea with the placarding, and you start looking, you're going to see there's more and more coming through.
And so is Chief Martin worried about this increase? And just as a quick follow-up, are he and other emergency responders doing anything to prepare for a derailment?
I wouldn't say worried, but I would definitely say aware. As he put it, when you see Lac-Mégantic or Castleton on TV, you think, maybe I should dust off those response plans for this kind of incident. So to that end, he says his team has been training on rail response. They're planning a crude oil-specific training in the near future in conjunction with the railways. And other teams across the state are doing similar trainings. BNSF says it held a training in Gillette in April and has one scheduled for Worland in September. It seems like both the emergency response community and the railroads are paying attention. So I asked Chief Martin whether he thinks right now Wyoming's emergency responders would be prepared to deal with the kind of derailment and explosion that we saw in Lynchburg this week. And he says, yeah.
We are trying to pre-plan and work and get ahead of this. So if something does happen, we do have contingency plans in place.
What about prevention, making sure these accidents don't happen in the first place?
Yeah, Bob, that's a really excellent point. And I think most people would say it's a problem that needs to be tackled from a couple of different angles. Wyoming doesn't have its own railroad regulatory agency or even really anybody who works directly with the railroads on safety issues. So any changes would have to be at the federal level for the most part. But I did speak with Representative Stan Blake of Green River, who, in addition to being a legislator, actually works for Union Pacific, although I should add that he stressed he is in no way speaking on behalf of the company. And he thinks there are basically two problems. The first one will have to be dealt with by the feds and industry, and that's modifying or switching out those DOT 111 cars for something a bit sturdier. But Blake also thinks that the state can play a role.
You just have to be ever vigilant in keeping these tracks up. Maybe Wyoming should look into getting a rail guy, somebody who could do some inspections.
You know, it's worth noting that derailments aren't just a problem with the track. In Lac-Mégantic, it was human error. In Castleton, the crude train actually ran into another train, although that first train had derailed because of problems with the track. And another thing that Representative Blake didn't bring up, but that others have, is better labeling. There's been a lot of criticism of the oil industry for inaccurate labeling of crude, especially coming out of the Bakken. And the federal agency in charge of the railroads has issued an emergency order that mandates additional testing, but it's not clear exactly how much of that's actually being done. Slower speed limits and routing the trains around communities have also been proposed at the federal level, but many people have pointed out that the railroad and oil lobbies are very strong in Washington. So whether those changes are actually going to be implemented is another question.
So does it seem like we're bound to see more of these accidents in the future?
Well, it's always dangerous to predict the future, but given the frequency of derailments in the recent past, I would say that the odds are high. I can say for sure that here in Wyoming, we're likely to see more crude trains as rail loading facilities continue popping up around the state. Those are the facilities that take oil from pipelines and load it onto trains. And by my count, there are currently 8, mostly in the Powder River Basin, but also in Uinta County, although there could be more. It doesn't seem like anybody really has a complete list. Grassroots pressure does seem to be building, though. Representative Blake has said he's going to raise the issue with the Transportation Committee, which he sits on. The Powder River Basin Resource Council is getting a group together to look at the problem and what can be done about it. And there's talk in Fort Laramie, where one of those rail loading facilities is located, of getting together a safety commission of communities along the track. So I think we can look forward to a lot more discussion of this issue in the near future.
Wyoming Public Radio Stephanie Joyce, thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Some of the best-paying jobs in Wyoming are in the oil and gas industry, but only 10% are held by women. Energy companies are trying to attract more women to fill open positions, but women who do want to enter the field for the higher-paying jobs face a lot of barriers. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports.
On a training rig on the outskirts of Casper, a group of young men in hard hats gathers around the rig elevators high up on the rig floor. The instructor, Cliff Sherwood, is showing them how to swing 2 massive pieces of metal and pull them back to latch together around the rig's pipe.
Anybody want to try this one? Huh? All right.
A student steps forward and gives it a try. Sherwood corrects him, stressing that proper technique is important.
No. In other words, if you're a little far this way, you may have to step to one side to latch it.
Rig workers have to be able to lift very heavy weights for long hours and often in bad weather. And Sherwood says because of these physical demands, a lot of his male students don't stick it out. As for women,
they've never made it through the door.
There's not a single woman in Sherwood's class, and very few women in the energy industry at all. Part of the reason is that so many of the jobs are very physically demanding. But it's also the schedule that's the problem. Rig workers are often out in the field far away from home for weeks on end, which is tough if you have children. Tika Perry is a single mom. She's taking a 6-week training course to become a welder and wants to get a job with the energy industry. She's got her childcare covered for the 6 weeks.
It's actually a home daycare, just a family friend of ours. She said that she would watch him for the 6 weeks that I do the class.
But she's not sure her friend will be able to continue the childcare once Perry gets a full-time job. She knows she's going to be working long hours and sometimes won't get home until late at night. And few, if any, energy companies offer childcare, especially outside the regular 9-to-5 workday. And as if a lack of childcare isn't enough, there's the problem of discrimination. Kelly Combs has been a pump truck operator for Halliburton for 2.5 years. She says she's experienced sexist comments on the job, and she feels like she has to work harder to get the same recognition her male coworkers receive.
Every day still, when there's new people out here, whether it be the people that we work for or my coworkers, you know, it's me being a female, and, you know, they're looking at me and judging me a lot more than their male counterparts.
Even so, Combs says she enjoys her job, especially working in the outdoors and collaborating on a team. And because her schedule gives her long breaks, she can travel all over the world.
I've been to Spain and I've been to Bucharest, Romania. Last year I went to Moscow and next year I'll go to Tanzania.
Combs is single, so the around-the-clock shifts don't compete with her family life. Her company, Halliburton, is trying to attract more women like her. They currently have a 19% female workforce. Lisa Finch is their diversity and inclusion officer.
Well, I think anytime you bring into the candidate pool an additional skill set or additional options, that's always a benefit. And considering that, you know, women are, they're half the population, that is a benefit to us.
Combs says another benefit is that women can help make the workplace safer, which is critical since Wyoming has a bad track record for workplace injuries and deaths. She says she's become a role model for her coworkers.
I don't work as fast as the other guys, but I can get the job done. They actually follow my lead now because it's safer.
But for many women, the obstacles are just too daunting. Representative Kathy Connolly wrote a report on Wyoming's gender wage gap, which is the worst of any state in the country. She says one of the big things keeping women away from the energy industry is the transient workforce and the reputation the industry has for violence and drugs and alcohol.
And the reality here of man camps is, you know, it's a reality. You've got a pocket full of cash, right? You're out of work for 5-8 days. You hang out with your buddies. That's not the best environment for thinking about community stability. It just isn't.
Not the right environment for community stability, and therefore not an attractive workplace for many women. Connolly says if companies want to hire more women, they have to change the work culture. For example, offering schedules that allow for a home life and childcare outside the regular 9-to-5 hours. Connolly says if that doesn't happen, the energy industry will likely continue to be mostly male-dominated, offering women much fewer options for high-paying jobs in the state. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
When we come back, we'll look at the impacts of energy production on housing values and look at why Senator Barrasso may oppose some pro-energy legislation. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. When there's an energy boom, it usually brings an influx of workers into the area, and that leads to more demand for housing. That's great for landlords who are looking to rent out their properties. But as some communities in Wyoming are finding, oil and gas drilling can actually be a problem for people who are looking to sell. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden reports.
Rhonda Holdbrook owns a real estate firm in Douglas, and she's exceptionally busy these days. Oil production in Converse County is booming, and energy workers have flocked to town.
Rentals are very hard to come by. They're very high-priced. Rent could be $2,500 a month for maybe a 2-to-3-bedroom.
But the market for renting and the market for selling are two different things. Christy Mogan lives just outside of Douglas in a modest single-family home. She raises cows, chickens, and goats, and grows vegetables in the summer. Mogan says her family used to love living here, but a few years ago, oil wells were drilled across the road from their neighborhood.
You can see a rig right there through the trees.
Mogan says the energy development has been a nightmare. Truck traffic on the dirt roads kicks up storms of dust. Foul odors sometimes waft through their windows. And when the wells were first put in, the noise from drilling rigs and flares kept the family up at night.
We, in our home, could not have a conversation over the flares.
After a nearby well blew out 2 years ago, spewing gas into the air, Mogan's children started having nosebleeds, and she and her husband have been diagnosed with hormonal problems. Doctors have not linked those issues to the nearby energy production, but Mogan thinks they're related, and she wants to get her family out.
We need to go. Our family's health is more important than anything else.
It's not easy to go, though. Mogan says her house has been on the market for nearly a year, and she's gotten no offers. Even if the house does sell, Mogan says it will probably be at a loss. She claims realtors told her to expect about $70,000 less than the house was appraised for a few years ago. Because of that, Mogan is not sure if her family can afford to move.
What are we going to have for a down payment? You know, what are we going to have to move on with?
Mogan thinks the oil wells are to blame for her house not selling. But realtors aren't so sure. Broker Rhonda Holdbrook says there are many factors that determine whether or not a house sells.
Location, neighborhood, covenants, bad condition. I don't see the oil field being a problem.
Other area realtors say the same thing. But several studies do point to energy development being a problem for homeowners. Researchers at Duke University looked at real estate in Pennsylvania and found that homes within a kilometer of gas wells decreased in value by 22%, at least if they relied on groundwater. A study in Weld County, Colorado, found a similar trend. Alex James at the University of Oxford is one of the authors of that report.
If you move a home 1 kilometer closer to a well, that will result in a $15,000 depreciation in its value. And given the data set that we're working with, that amounts to about a 7% reduction in home price.
James says part of the reason prices are dropping is exactly what you'd expect. The view from the front porch isn't as nice if there's a well pad on the horizon, and people don't like the noise and commotion associated with production. But there's another issue. James says people tend to fear fracking, even if no environmental or health problems have been documented in the area.
When somebody's making a home purchasing decision, they're not basing their decision off of, you know, what does the scientific evidence say about the likelihood of a fracked well contaminating my water supply. They're looking at a New York Times article that talks about how puppies in Pennsylvania are being born without legs and cleft palates and things like this.
In places where environmental problems have been documented, property values have slumped even more. In Pavilion, where the Environmental Protection Agency tentatively linked groundwater contamination to fracking, the County Board of Equalization determined that affected houses were worth 50% less than before. Economists are quick to point out that despite the decrease in property values, oil and gas booms are generally good for local economies. For example, because average incomes go up.
But if you're a homeowner and your wage doesn't increase due to the fracking boom and your neighbors put a well pad in their backyard, you're going to lose. Your home's going to be worth less and your income's not going to go up.
Chris Timmons, who co-authored the study out of Duke University, says the ironic problem is that there just aren't enough people in that situation.
The negative impacts can be on a very small number of people, and that can make them easier to ignore if there's big benefits to a large number of people and the negative impacts are on a small number of people. The political economy of that can lead to things working out for the drillers. I mean, there's just not the right kind of opposition.
And he says that means that as more wells are drilled, nearby homeowners could be the people who stand to lose the most from energy booms. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
The U.S. Senate is expected to have a debate on a bipartisan bill aimed at increasing energy efficiency in the U.S., but it could get derailed by an oil pipeline in the Midwest. Matt Laszlo has the story from Washington on Wyoming Senator John Barrasso's role in the ongoing debate.
The federal government is the single biggest consumer of energy in the U.S., so a bipartisan group of lawmakers want to make it an example to the private sector. The Shaheen-Portman Energy Bill attempts to do that by increasing energy efficiency in everything from federal workers' computers to federal buildings themselves. Virginia Democratic Senator Tim Kaine says it's good the bill also increases efficiency standards for buildings nationwide.
The conservation and efficiency technologies are amazing. You know, they can do so much. And so accelerating that in the federal space through this legislation is really smart. And it's something that we ought to be able to all be on the same page on.
Wyoming Senator John Barrasso voted in favor of the bill in the Energy Committee. But he now wants the debate to be broader than just energy efficiency. Barrasso and other Republican leaders are negotiating a way to get an up or down vote on the controversial Keystone XL pipeline, which would run from Canada to the Gulf Coast, and also his liquefied natural gas bill, or LNG.
We're saying we should have a substantive discussion on energy and debate on energy, including Keystone, including LNG, including coal regulations. There are a number of different components that need to be a part of a discussion if there is a bill related to energy on the floor.
As for Keystone, Barrasso wants clear direction from the Senate.
I want something to actually go to the president's desk that says approve Keystone and he signs it. And if he wants to veto it, he gets to do that.
Although the proposed pipeline doesn't cut through Wyoming, Congresswoman Cynthia Lummis says it would still be a win for the state.
But we have pipe manufacturers, and that is a business that is really fledgling in my state, very new to my state.
Barrasso says that's partly why he's lobbying so hard to get a broad array of energy amendments debated.
If we aren't allowed to have an open debate on different issues of energy and a broad debate on energy itself, then I would think that we've missed a great opportunity.
Barrasso stops short of saying he'll filibuster the bill if his demand of a Keystone vote isn't met. But Senator Kaine, A former Virginia governor says he just doesn't understand that negotiating tactic.
I haven't been in the Senate long enough to know why if something is good, you would say, I won't do something good unless you do five other things I want. If it's good, we ought to do it. The committee supported it. It's bipartisan. We ought to do it.
Barrasso counters that he understands American voters better than the president.
You take a look at some of the criticism that's coming at the president from all sides of this and how he's being held hostage by environmental extremists. You know, I think that for people that want to have jobs, for people looking to work, for people that have been long-term unemployed, they're being hurt every day by the president's delay.
As for the pipeline, the House has passed dozens of energy-related bills, including the Keystone Pipeline. But Lummis is frustrated bills die in the Senate.
Republicans don't understand why Democrats wouldn't want to make the strongest growth element in our economy, which is energy production and pipelines and the abundant energy we have, an issue that both parties can share.
But Senator Kaine says the energy efficiency bill is important on its own. He says the broad bipartisan coalition behind it can also send a message to a public that is fed up with Congress.
We ought to be looking to do those things just to show people, look, we know how to work together.
Party leaders continue to negotiate just how many amendments to allow and whether to allow a standalone vote on the pipeline. If that happens, it just may pass with the support of rank-and-file Democrats, which analysts say would embarrass the president at a time when his approval rating continues to slump. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
The Continental Divide Trail is a 3,000-mile path that stretches from Canada to Mexico, passing through Wyoming and several other states. It was designated a National Scenic Trail in the 1970s, meaning that a mile-wide corridor is protected for the entire length of the trail. But the Continental Divide Trail Coalition, which maintains the trail, says the trail still faces threats from nearby development. We're joined now by the coalition's director, Teresa Martinez. She says protecting the trail's viewshed is particularly crucial in Wyoming.
Let's say you're in the Great Basin of Wyoming and there's not a lot of trees. It's a big, wide, open landscape. 1 mile is not very far, or half a mile on either side of you is not very far. And so we still look at the area outside of that border, things like energy developments, in particular transmission corridors, or as much as we love alternative power, wind power and solar energy. Currently, right now, some of the challenges are, in fact, a wind power development project that's south of Rawlins. And it's also the same location of an energy transmission corridor. When we talk about National Scenic Trails, typically we're trying to keep a primitive, remote backcountry experience. So as you can imagine, having a wind tower or transmission line come across, well, that definitely is going to impact that experience of primitive, remote, and backcountry. So working with companies to sort of rethink how those crossings or those developments next to or adjacent to the corridor occur. For example, with energy transmission corridors like the one that's crossing near Rawlins, thinking about a perpendicular crossing versus something that's going to parallel the trail for a long time. So as a hiker or as a horseback rider or some sort of user, you're coming across, you cross it, and then you're gone from it. We are trying to ensure that that creates an experience that allows for stripping away all the other noise and coming to some place that allows for some level of transcendence or transformation or just experiencing these nationally significant resources that are protected along and within that corridor.
Now, one of the issues that you're facing is that the trail isn't actually completed. People will hike the whole thing, but there are places where they have to follow alternate routes and sort of connect these fragmented pieces of trail. So what's the outlook for actually getting the whole thing completed? Who decides where this trail will go precisely? And I mean, I can imagine this could be a bit difficult to agree on if you're dealing with lots of different land management agencies.
Absolutely. Yeah. The CDT is unique in that it came on 10 years after, for example, the Pacific Crest and Appalachian Trail. And while the public was really engaged, it wasn't really until 1995 that a huge effort towards completing the trail was really embarked upon. Actually, in Wyoming, we're furthest along. We're really close to completion. There's no more lands to purchase. It's really just constructing the trail, and most of that trail is, while there is a route, it's not in the best location or the highest, what we call the optimal location for the CDT. It's in a, it connects two pieces of forest lands, but it's probably not the optimal location that provides the highest quality recreational experience. And so we're in the process of identifying that route so that we can then build it. And so now it's just getting the volunteers and the youth corps and various other groups involved to help construct it.
So 10 years down the road, what do you hope will the trail will be like?
10 years down the road, I think I'm hoping we're done. The stage that we're in now is really getting the public engaged in the day-to-day stewardship and the maintenance of the trail. So once we have it built, that's not the end of the job. The job is then keeping it open and keeping it passable so that people can, in fact, enjoy the trail that we've spent all this time to create and construct and protect. And then also just promoting the trail in the right way so that people do want to come and use it. And so we look at things like gateway communities and in Wyoming, like Rawlins, which is a natural hub for everyone who uses the CDT for resupply and getting a shower and getting a good meal, engaging with those communities to help embrace the trail. So we really are, there's really this incredible asset that's delivered to the local communities where the trail passes that provides some additional economic benefit to those communities.
I'm curious, obviously the Appalachian Trail on the East Coast, thousands of people attempt that mm-hmm. each year. The Continental Divide Trail gets a lot less traffic. Do you see it ever becoming, you know, quite as popular, I guess, as some of these other trails that, you know, that get all this traffic?
That's like a double-edged sword question. I want to say yes, because I think that demonstrates how important this trail as a resource to the American public is, and demonstrates why it's worth protecting and why it's worth putting federal funding towards it and why it's worth supporting. On the same respect, one of the beautiful characteristics of the CDT is it's so remote. You know, and there's something fundamental in us as human beings when we come to a place where we are stripped of convenience and connection that actually, while we might disconnect from all that technology and stuff that is in our day-to-day, when we're in a place where we're literally looking around and there's nothing and no one for miles, something fundamental happens to us as human beings that I think is important, that helps us reconnect to really core values we are as not just human beings, but as people who belong together in this landscape. And so while, yes, it's not heavily used, I think that that's almost its beauty because it provides for that opportunity. Having said that, one of the things we've spent a lot of time doing is mapping the official route so that people can, in fact, hike it. And we're also helping develop more resources and services along the trail with our gateway communities so that as people come into town, they actually have resources to have the needs met that they need when they come off the trail.
Teresa Martinez is director of the Continental Divide Trail Coalition. Teresa, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
If you're interested in volunteering on trail making efforts, you can find more information at continentaldividetrail.org.
When we come back, we'll hear from University of Wyoming football coach Craig Boll, who will give his assessment on spring ball and other topics. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. University of Wyoming football coach Craig Boll has been a winner at a number of places. While an assistant coach at Nebraska, the Cornhuskers won two national championships, and his last three teams at North Dakota State won the last three football championship subdivision national championships. He is taking over a Wyoming team that has struggled with consistency in recent years, especially on defense. Ball is friendly but businesslike. Unlike most football coaches, he wears a jacket and a tie to work. He says the transition to Wyoming has been a good one.
You know what? As a young boy, our family used to vacation out here. And my father was stationed at the Air Force Base over in Cheyenne. And so I had somewhat of a familiarity with our state. And the other thing that made this transition probably as smooth as what it could be was, you know, the states of Nebraska and North Dakota and Wyoming, while there are some differences, there's probably more similarities than differences. And I've had a chance to travel our state, and boy, what a great state that we have here.
It's the honeymoon period, certainly, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, you know what, and I'm very realistic in that. You know, football coaches, we live in dog years. And while we're representing our school, and it's so important that our players matriculate through and develop into men as they come through, we're also very aware of the fact that, the demands of a college football coach are high. And our performance on the field is important. And so how long this honeymoon period lasts, I certainly don't know. We've enjoyed it. I've enjoyed it. But we also realize, you know what, the rubber's going to meet the road. We've got to put a good product on the field. And I think our fans and our state will see that.
Explain to folks who maybe are just casually following this, what's your philosophy, what you think you're going to be bringing to Wyoming?
Well, I think anytime you have a successful college football team, the number one criteria is to know who you are. Understand the fabric and the nature of the people in our state, because that football team, if it's going to be successful, has to marry up with the type of people we have in our state. And the one thing that I have found about, the citizens in our state, we're resourceful, we're resilient. People are honest. They don't want somebody that's going to come in and overpromise and underdeliver. Just look them straight in the eye and tell them who you are, what you're about, and where you're going. I recognize that we're representing a university that's a national land-grant institution, a doctoral institution. We're not a comprehensive institution. And then also, along with that, we're in a great conference. The Mountain West Conference is comprised of some great institutions. It's very competitive. But as I walk out onto our field and I see all the historic bowl games and the teams that we've had here, for us to return Cowboy football back to national prominence is going to be something important for the citizens in our state.
You've obviously been looking at the history of the team and noticed there's been fits and starts over the last several years. Is there a way to turn the corner? I imagine you think the answer is yes, and how do you do that?
Well, we wouldn't have come here if we didn't feel a firm conviction that that there's a great chance for success. I think a lot of it is having some consistency. We've got an experienced coaching staff. There's a sound philosophy that we believe is going to work here. A lot of it starts into recruiting and changing the culture within our football team. We appreciate our players right now. They bought in to, our style of football that we're going to reintroduce. But if you look historically, when Wyoming has been successful, they've been able to be Cowboy tough. And that's something that may be something easy to say, and that's a process that you go through to develop that culture. But football is a physical game. It's a team game, and it involves an awful lot of different elements. And to be able to go in and say, okay, what is Cowboy tough football? We believe we have the formula, and our fans will see it. Now, it's going to be a process. You'll see a difference this fall. But as we develop our program through the years, you will see a different element and a different type of team that's out there.
One of the things that you're bringing to the team is a focus, starting with defense and the lines and that sort of thing. Could you talk a little bit about what you're doing?
Well, I appreciate you bringing that up, because as our fans and our listeners that are out there, they'll look and they'll see college football, and you see all the big plays and the touchdowns and things of that. But to really make this system go, you've got to be strong in the lines of scrimmage. And that's a tough place to start. And it's a man's game played by men up front. And so the defense is really important. Quite frankly, there's more teams that lose on Saturday than win. And to the listeners that are out there, they're probably scratching your head saying, what did the coach just say there? Well, the facts is, offense sells tickets and defense wins championships, and we're going to reestablish and play great defense here.
more of a running game out of Wyoming than maybe we've seen in the past.
Well, that's certainly true. We're going to leverage that, and we'll be a run-first football team. That's going to take a little time to develop. A lot of that comes into being able to control the line of scrimmage. Some of the things is you take the elements of wind and snow and rain. All those things go out the window if you can run the football and control the football. Late in the fourth quarter, you always see the most physical dominant team typically wins, and that's going to be part of our formula.
Well, you had some bad luck when you came here. You lost your starting quarterback and a very good backup quarterback, and so you've been retooling. You've looked at the quarterbacks this spring. I mean, that's one thing everybody wants to ask you about. How does it look?
Well, we're a work in progress there. I think if you just – any learned college football fan will say if you're down to your third-string quarterback right away – you've got some challenges, and we appreciate the efforts of our quarterbacks. I think it's going to be important that we put them in position to be successful, not ask them to do the things like Peyton Manning, but play within themselves. And that comes down to leveraging the strengths that we have within our football team, talking about our defense, talking about our running game, to where that quarterback is not in position where he has to make a play every single down.
Could you tell me a little bit about the spring? You had a chance to finally look at the team and assess them. I remember talking with Paul Roach many years ago, and he said, well, there might be a glimmer of hope, Bob, but I'm not so sure after the spring. I'm wondering what you think.
You know what? It exceeded my expectations and our expectations as a staff. The first thing that everybody asked me, what have you liked most about Wyoming? And I say the attitude of our players. They're young men who really want to be good. We got to show them how to be good. I think within our football team, you know what, we've got maybe more talented running backs than what I had anticipated. Our lines of scrimmage, particularly on the defensive lines, a little bit stronger. And so, and I think we've got a solid kicking game.
Coach Craig Bohl, a pleasure. Thank you.
You bet. Thanks.
The Cowboys open their season on August 30th against Montana in Laramie.
This week, Wyoming Public Radio reporter Irina Zhoroff left Wyoming for a new job in Pittsburgh. When Irina came to Wyoming from Philadelphia in 2010, she had questions about her new state. When she graduated from her master's program in 2012, she wrote us this essay called Letter to Wyoming. We thought we'd share it again.
We are friends now, Wyoming, so I feel I can be honest. I thought you were a loser when we first met. You were lonely and vengeful with your wind, your plains like cold, empty bedsheets tucked into snow-covered mountains, polka-dotted with undulates and dead towns. But then on that coldest day, do you remember? We boiled water and threw it in the crisp air, and it turned to snowflakes, and I started to fall for you. In the dead towns, I met cowboys with their throats wrapped in silk wild rags, and on roads where you can drive fast, I found steely skies that stretched out into impossible horizons. At the Hobo Hot Springs, I met a man that looked like a Viking, and in the forest, I prospected for gold in the glacial streams, and on a ranch, I fished snakes out of a canal, and in the mountains, I traced petroglyphs with my finger, and everywhere, I watched trains trudge across landscapes in endless caravans, and I met people with faces open as the land, soft-spoken as the ready snow, with belt buckles big as the sky. I ran my hands against your thick seams of coal in the basin, too, and I have not forgotten your whiteouts that made it seem like the world was made of cold cotton candy. Also, I'm still not sure about these loud souped-up trucks, dear. And I remember Matthew Shepard and my landlord, who thought I had an attitude problem because she couldn't pronounce my name. Sometimes, too, the loneliness and the starkness still reign. This isn't goodbye, Wyoming. This isn't a proposition of any sort. I sunned yesterday on granite slabs in a field of blue columbines, and tomorrow it may snow. And I feel all right about that. I thought I would let you know just that, that you're all right, dear. I'm Irina Zhorov.
That's our program for this week. If you'd like to hear the entire show or individual segments, you can go to our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just look for Open Spaces. You can also share ideas for future programs on that site. Anna Rader is our web editor.
As you just heard, we're saying goodbye to Irina Zhoroff. We're also saying goodbye to our friend and co-host, Willow Belden, who will leave the station on Monday. They will both certainly be missed. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.